Well, hello. Welcome to episode 85 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name's Robert. I'm here with Scott. We've got an awesome guest for the day. Before we get started, if you would, go follow us on Twitter. And if you want to support the podcast, you can subscribe to our podcast on Twitter. Not all the episodes are out for free for everybody, but subscribers get access to all the episodes all the time. So you can go to twitter.com, just search Payers Players and subscribe there. Scott, you want to introduce today's guest?
Yeah, for sure. And before we do that, just wanted to also promote the fact that we just released our class of 2023 player pathway, where it looks at all the top 100 boys and girls from the class of 23 and sort of takes a dive into their history, ranking history, UTR history, where they went to college, and we identify some trends and some interesting facts. So if you want to take a look at that, subscribe and you have access to it. Today we have Mark Lucero is our guest on episode number 85. Mark grew up in San Diego and played collegiately at Boston College. After a year of law school at USD, he quit law school and went to coach the women's team at Princeton as the assistant coach. After there for a couple of years, he returned to the West Coast and joined the USTA campus in Carson, and he's gone on to coach pro players such as Jeannie Bouchard, Nicole Gibbs, Shelby Rogers, and Stevie Johnson. Mark's a serial podcast guest. He's been on several podcasts, so if you like this one, you'll probably want to go hear some more of him on many other podcasts. And he also has his own podcast called Check the Mark. And lastly, he's also a commentator on the Tennis Channel. So with that background, welcome to the show, Mark.
Hey, guys. Happy to be here. Really enjoyed listening to your last few episodes with a couple of my former coworkers at the USTA, David Roditi and David Mankin. And love what you guys are doing for the game for junior tennis and collegiate tennis specifically. Really cool.
Appreciate it. Thanks. We'll get into some of your relationships with Nankin and Roditi and your experience with them, but we'll get into that later. But want to start with, sort of your tennis background. Personally, I grew up in San Diego, so I'm sort of interested to hear your tennis background in San Diego and how you got started and who you worked with.
Yeah, so, I got started in the way I think a lot of people do, in a very, organic way. It just kind of happened one summer that my younger brother and I started doing a group lesson once a week with two of my other friends from my class at school, and we just, at the end of the summer, we played tennis once a week, and usually it was a lesson where we were taking turns, seeing who could hit the most home runs out of the court, and by the end of the summer, I really liked it. My brother did as well, and we kept going, and my parents kind of helped facilitate our sort of tennis background while we played the other sports. I mean, we both played, all the basketball, baseball. I only played two seasons of baseball, mostly soccer. So I played soccer through the ninth grade. My first kind of serious coaches were, one was a guy named Bill Foley, who had a court at his house down in Chula Vista. We'd kind of make the trek down there to go to his court. And then when I got better and a little more serious in high school, I worked mostly with a guy named Jim Ault, who unfortunately just passed away recently. But he was a really, really pivotal figure in my junior background. And he's someone who really, we coach often how we were coached as kids. And he's someone who I think about a lot when I think about sometimes how to handle some of these situations. And so those were the two big kind of coaches in my junior career. And in college, when I'd come back to town, I started working with a guy named Manolo Ortiz, who really helped me a lot, specifically mentally. But it was Bill Foley and Jim Ault who did a lot of the heavy lifting. They were based first at a place called Folsom's, which is on Oklahoma Boulevard in Hillcrest. And then eventually they both moved over to the Barnes Tennis Center when it was built my sophomore year in high school. I think they completed it. So that's kind of the short, quick version.
Perfect. And then how did you end up at Boston College? I know that San Diego is a pretty nice place to be, but Boston College is a clear on the other side of the country, much different climate. So how did you end up at Boston College?
Yeah, I had this idea that I wanted to be on one of the coasts. I wanted to be kind of near the ocean for some reason. And when I was visiting some schools, I really enjoyed BC. I liked the idea. It's kind of a very romantic notion for kids from the West Coast, I think, to go to school in the Northeast and see the change of seasons and to do that whole sort of adventure. And that's kind of the way I saw it. I saw it as this kind of complete, change from what I was used to, and this complete adventure. The first time I saw snow was my freshman year winter at BC. And luckily, what kind of worked out too, there were four kids from my class at my high school who ended up at Boston College. So you know, I had this whole little crew that was already built in. Plus, there were two guys on the team who were a year older than me that I had grown up with in San Diego, a guy named Jason Cowett, who now is like a hedge fund guy, and then my buddy Rich Bull, who so these guys were both, they were both sophomores at BC when I was a freshman, and I had both played these guys, you know, since I started playing tournaments when I was, you know, whatever, 12 years old. So yeah, I had my whole little crew built in, and then we were, it's like we were all facing these things, you know, for the first time together. Like the first, you know, when our van was hit black ice on the way to a road match, like in January, like, you know, the three of us were in the back of the car, like, you know, freaking out together, and everyone else was like, yeah, this is totally normal. But yeah, so it, you know, it was nice to have a, you know, a group of people to kind of do it with and to go through it all with and to not feel, you know, I never had that feeling of isolation. So that really helped.
Nice. And so, you know, one of the things I really am curious about is, you know, with your background, you know, maybe not playing, you know, professional tennis at, you know, the ATP level, how do you get into becoming an ATP WTA coach? You know, I'd like to know maybe, you know, sort of what that path was for you, you know, after you got to USTA and then, you know, developing the relationships and the skill set to become, you know, a coach that has coached at the very highest level.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, I think coaching pro players takes a great deal of humility, and you have to be able to put yourself in their shoes and to see the game through their eyes. And I actually think it's a lot easier when you weren't very good as a player. You know, like when you're a really good player, I think you have a specific idea about how things are done, about how the game is played. And I think, frankly, that's the reason you don't see a ton. I mean, I think you see, you know, now we're seeing a lot of, you know, what I call kind of like master coaches or these super coaches, you know, guys who want, or, you know, or women too, who want at the highest level, like a Maresmo or whatever it is, helping out players. But I think, you know, you look at the team sports, you know, the NBA, NHL, NFL, you see a lot of people who are kind of journeyman type players, you know, become some of the best coaches or people who didn't even, you know, actually play the game at the highest level, just because I think they're able to sort of be a little bit more like chameleons and to see the game, you know, see how to put their players in positions to be successful, you know, obviously through the lens of their philosophy and sort of how they, you know, the whatever non-negotiables they might have. And for me, like my journey, when I was at Princeton, after 3 years there, I kind of had this idea that I wanted to work individually with people. And then I thought that I could coach at the pro level. I wasn't quite sure, I think, looking back now, like what really that meant. But through time, and specifically like with my time at the USTA, like I was around some unbelievable people that really helped mold me, and to really help me, get me to understand what's it like, you know, what it's like to be around these players. I mean, I was around on a daily basis. I was around coaches like, you know, Tom Gullickson, Jose Higueras, and, you know, coaches who have been around the greats in the game, coaches who have won, you know, numerous Grand Slams, you know, David Roditi, David Nankin, Roger Smith, Ray Ruffles, like these coaches, you know, Laurie McNeil. So unbelievable. It was like, you know, it was like a doctoral program for being a coach. It was just on a daily basis, being able to watch these people operate, watch the players who came to campus to work with them, and to see that the way that they interacted and related with them, it was incredible. And it was like this, like I said, it was like this crash course in how to be a coach and how to be, you know, a coach at the highest level. And I'm grateful on a daily basis for that opportunity. And it really sort of helped put me on that path. And, you know, it kind of created too this sort of feeling that being around these players was, you know, not normal, but it was kind of like just like what you did. And, you know, you have to treat them like people. And the thing that I learned about these players was that they want to be coached. They want to be told the truth. And, you know, they see right through people that either don't believe what they're saying or people that'll, you know, blow hot air up their rear end. And so for me, that was really important on my kind of journey.
So I often wonder when I see pro coaches and pro players working together, it almost seems like each of those relationships has a beginning, middle, and end, and they all go through that cycle and then they move on. Why do you think some of the pros, though, like Rafa Nadal with Uncle Tony, that cycle didn't go quite as quickly? I mean, he made it through a lot of his career with them together, where in other cases, that cycle may take a year or two. Is it just coaches run out of things to say to the players, the relationship becomes stale? Why do you think there's some of that movement?
Yeah, I think it's sort of a combination of all of them. I mean, I think I bring it back to the team sports. When you look at some of the most successful dynasties, there's usually a great deal of organizational stability. And I think a lot of the really, I think, really successful players have very, very stable coaching relationships. I mean, I think it takes a high level of commitment from both the coach and the player, you know, from a coach who wants to be in his or her current situation, who's very, very committed to the long term, the big vision, like the big picture vision for making that player, you know, a better player and a better person in the big picture, not just like, hey, I'm going to try to maximize this year and like really make a ton of cash and see what I can get out of it and then parlay it into something else. I mean, I think if both player and coach don't share that sort of vision or share that basic philosophy, and clearly that's something that, you know, that Tony and Rafa from a very, very young age, you know, being family doesn't hurt, but I think having that, you know, that shared vision, those shared values, that lends itself to a long-term relationship. And I remember one time when I was working with Shelby Rogers, and we were 5 years together, which I think is fairly stable. I was in her kitchen one time and we were just chatting, and I think in between practices, and I was like, you know, I was like, Shelby, like, are you totally on board with like the things that I think are important? And she like looked at me like I was crazy. She's like, of course. She's like, otherwise we wouldn't have worked together for this long. And I was like, okay, just making sure, you know, because sometimes you just need to ask. But because, you know, you find yourself saying these things over and over, and, you know, usually the player kind of like either nods or just kind of like, you know, like listens and doesn't often say much. And sometimes you're like, God, am I like getting through like on a deep level? But yeah, to answer your question, you know, these situations that are shorter, a lot of times, you know, I think there's times when the players know, or players and coaches, you know, usually know that it's not working. And then there's times where, you know, someone is just not all in. And I think that's unfortunate because, you know, it's just, there's so many intricacies to the coach-player relationship in tennis because there isn't that, you know, insulation, you know, from the coach and the player with, you know, a bunch of assistant coaches or, you know, a general manager or, you know, a director of pro scouting or whatever it is. Like, it's the player and the coach. And then there's an agent sometimes who will run interference. But it's because of, I think, the highly personal nature, too, of that relationship and the amount of time, like, you actually will spend together on the road, especially if it's a small team, you know, a lot of meals, a lot of practices. Like, you know, people can get burned out, and that can lead to some relationships that are shorter than maybe they should be or would be based on, you know, how successful they may or may not have been.
Yeah. So talk me through this real quick. So that makes a lot of sense. So I'm wondering, I mean, you think about a pro player, you get a player at the highest level, strokes are usually in really good shape, serve technique's probably awesome, forehand, backhand, probably in great shape, volley in great shape. So, and then they also have won for a long time if they're at that level, right? If they're 25 years old, number say 50 in the world, there's a lot of water under the bridge for them to make it to that point. So what do you, give me three real tangible things that you're actually coaching. Because it's probably not let's hit your serve a little different. It's probably let's develop this pattern to complement that pattern that you're already good at. Give me some examples of actual tangible things on a day-to-day basis that you're working with those players on.
I mean, first and foremost, it's, you know, it's listening to the player and seeing where they think they're vulnerable, because everybody has something that they're vulnerable about, or either that it's real or not real. But even if it's not real, if they think it's a vulnerability, then it's something that I think needs to be addressed. And even if it's just some window dressing to make them feel good about it, I think that's, you know, that's crucial to starting off the relationship on the right foot, especially because it's generally pretty low hanging fruit.
Sorry for interrupting. So it starts with, where's your vulnerability and how can we either hide it or strengthen it? So an example of that with Brad Gilbert and Coco Gauff have been, everybody talked about her forehand. For me, I think that people overblow her forehand. And I think it probably just caused a mental insecurity or uneasiness with her forehand. And it seems to me like he didn't change anything except just to get her to believe in it. Would you say that that's
100%? You need to make them feel good about it. And if, you know, if the situation, you know, if you get a player like that, like the message, you know, particularly with a pro player, it's going to be tough to rebuild some like technique in a really serious way unless you have like a huge chunk of time. But a lot of times the message is going to be, you know, especially because, like you said, generally the technique is fine. It's serviceable. So you need to tell them, hey, you need to go out there and hit it. You need to go out and hit that four, if it's, you know, whatever, Coco. Hey, go, we want you to go out there and swing at it, you know, because if you're, the second you're afraid, I was just working on something right now for a player. And in my notes, I was like, I need to get this person to actually swing at it. Because once, when players swing at it, when they accelerate, you know, they're going to probably hit it well because they're so good and they've hit so many balls. And, you know, you're going to get safety from the spin. You're not going to get safety from slowing the racket head down and decelerating. So they need to fully commit to the swing. So it's going to be getting them comfortable doing that. I think, like, that's one. Two, that's, like, when you're
– before you go to two, that's a great one. Like, I think what you just described is not valued enough in the coaching world, that, hey, you're already good enough. Let's just get you to believe in yourself. That's a big one. I just can't believe how many coaches overlook that. Okay, what's number two?
Well, sorry, and I'm gonna pull on that a little more. Sometimes it's situational because, you know, how many players have we seen, like, hey, like, everything looks great at 2-all, you know what I mean? But you see that crack that happens over and over when it's 5-6, 30-40, you know what I mean? You don't see, and I try to tell players this, you're not gonna see that other player's weakness until there's a ton of scoreboard pressure. You know, you're not gonna see, like, everyone's gonna play well when they're up 3-0, you know? We need to get to, like, 6-all. We need to get into that breaker. We need to get them to break point to see what's going to break down. And trust me, it's going to break down. Everybody has something that's going to, you know, it's going to go away in that moment, but you have to get them there. And if you don't get them there, you're not going to see it. So I think that is really, really important.
Well, and Scott and I talk a lot. I mean, there's a lot of the research out there of how short points are on WTA and most are not, or on the ATP, and most of them are 4 balls or less. But I think those statistics are a little misleading because when it counts most, the best players don't break down. And to me, that's the difference. I mean, you watch Nadal, Djokovic, Federer, they seem to be at their best when other players were most commonly breaking down.
Right, 100%. And that's why they win the most. That's why they don't vary, you know, from week to week very much. That's why they have, you know, good results year round. And, you know, one of the players who I used to work with, like, what she didn't feel good about was a shot that most people would say she hits pretty well. And so I would have to tell her, listen, in the first game of the match, I don't care where it goes, but I need you to hit the backhand down line. I need you to hit one backhand down line in the first game of the match. I don't care if you miss it in the net, wide, whatever, but I need you to do it because you're not going to do it when it's 5-all if you haven't hit one yet. You know what I mean? Yes. You need to do something early in the match to give you a little bit of belief, a little bit of familiarity with that shot that you're not comfortable with, because I need you to be able to make that decision on a big point later in the match. And you're not going to do it for the very first, you know, players aren't going to do something for the very first time when it's a huge point. You know, like in college, like, you tell a team to play I that hasn't played I like the whole season, you know, they're not going to do it on a deciding point at, you know, 7-6 or whatever, 6-5 in the set, you know what I mean? With the match coming down to their doubles point, it's just not going to happen. So I think you need to put players in positions. And then part of that is coaching, you know, the tactics. Part of that is coaching sort of the game plan. I think you need to put players in positions to be able to do things when it really matters by making sure that they do things when it doesn't matter, if that makes sense.
So does that mean that Federer, Djokovic, Nadal just didn't have a weakness, so there was nothing to break down at that moment? Or were there weaknesses and they just were able to not have them break down at those moments?
I mean, it's so hard because with those guys, you know, there were, I mean, I should qualify this because I've, you know, when I was coaching Stevie, he never beat any of those guys. So it's hard to say, but with those guys, there are generally places on the court where you can play so that you can potentially create opportunities, but you're not just going to get free points from those guys. So you need to sort of do a sequence. And that's why those guys are so difficult to beat, because usually it takes a sequence of good shots in order to put yourself in a winning position. And that's really, really hard to do.
Can you give us an example? Give us an example of one of those sequences.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if for Federer, if you can somehow, I mean, you know, he's obviously the easiest to talk about since he's the furthest removed from playing and because he has a one-handed backhand. But if you could sort of find a way to put him in trouble on the backhand and get a slice in the midcourt, you know, you generally, like, you know, for Stevie could find a forehand, but it's really, really hard because if Roger, you know, chips his forehand up the line to Stevie's forehand with his, you know, with his Western grip, like, he's going to have a hard time with that. Like, if Roger doesn't sort of play the pattern and come back to you in the middle of the court. I mean, for a Novak, like, you know, it's totally different because, you know, even he's able to take away time over and over, and of course at that point without taking any risk, and you're in a lot of trouble. I mean, it's tough to, like, I was talking about Sinner the other day to somebody, and I said, you know, I watched this guy kill Stevie multiple times. Like, I don't know how to tell this guy, like, how to beat him. You know, you would have to do something so well over and over again, and then these guys can just come, especially like a Novak, and he can come out of the blue and hit his backhand at the line, and you're in trouble if you're trying to set up your best shots. So yeah, it's those guys are pretty special. I mean, with Nadal, it's like, if he's leaving the ball short on one of his shot strokes, specifically the forehand, you can try to take the ball on the rise and hurt him and take away a little time on a quicker court. But if it's on clay, good luck.
Well, that makes sense. All right. So what's number two? Cause I'm going to be honest, this insight into the small intricacies of the highest level. I mean, we were watching the ITA All-American, what's today, Tuesday? Sunday, and the two players were basically even I was sitting there, Everett and I, my son, and I said, who's got a better serve? Even. Who's got a better forehand? Even. Who's got a better backhand? Even. So when all that stuff's even, what's the difference in the match, right? And so I think you're giving us a good insight into what those differences are. So what's number two?
A lot of times, what we work on a lot, we know with all these players, you know, I've spent a lot of time with, a lot of time is ball recognition. It's recognizing, you know, what a short ball really is, because when you're, again, playing at the highest level, like, short balls don't look that short, but there are chances for you to take some court. And for me, like, the most important part of the court would probably be the 3 feet in front of the baseline and the 3 feet behind the baseline. And if you're just watching a couple, you know, I'll use college guys. If you're watching a couple college players play, a lot of times, like, yeah, this is my experience. I see a lot of, like, when I call the ACC tournament, I see a lot of balls go that they continue to hit as rally balls, that a pro player would step up and hit the crap out of it and hurt you in the corner, and the point's over in two shots from there. But a lot of times these players, even players, you know, playing in the top, you know, top three spots in the lineup who are good players, are not seeing these balls, and they're continuing to kind of lift the ball and play heavy. And with these pro players, it's constantly finding these opportunities, helping them see what for them is a short ball, helping them identify these situations, and being really good at that footwork in that, you know, that 6 feet of the court that I mentioned, the 3 feet in front of the baseline, 3 feet behind the baseline, you know, taking ground, taking away time, that sort of thing. Because today, like, the game has become so much about taking away time from opponents, that if you're not doing that and someone's taking away time from you, like, if you're playing off the back foot for too long, like, you're really going to be in trouble and have a hard time winning.
You know, that one's a real good point. You think about the difference in a college and a pro quarterback in the NFL and college football. The difference is a pro quarterback, what Tom Brady saw as open, a college quarterback would have called covered, right?
100%. Yeah.
And so but coaches are able to coach it up. I'll give you an example. A tight end running straight up the field, linebacker's got his back to the quarterback, and you just throw it over that linebacker's shoulder, left or right shoulder, to the tight end. In college, they're not open. In the pros, because their heads turned away, they're open. So how do you train that, though? Because I've seen exactly what you're describing. How do you get a player that views a ball as neutral, but in reality it was short, and be more aggressive to take and do damage on that ball?
Yeah, I think it starts in practice. I mean, I think you can, you know, and this is something, you know, at the USGA, like when Jose Higueras came in, we spent a ton of time on this. And I think the message got a little misconstrued to different parts of the country. But, you know, because I was in LA and Jose was coming from Palm Springs, so, you know, I got to be around him, you know, 3-4 days a week a lot of times. And so, you know, I was kind of was able to get really specific on, you know, what he was talking about when we were talking about taking away time. But to get to your question, you know, it starts in practice, and it starts with, you know, it starts with, you know, you can do something as easy as feeding the player balls, and you can, you know, get out there with your forehand grip and feed that same sort of top spinny ball, or do like the Spanish kind of bounce speed where the ball bounces on, where you hit the ball hard into the ground on your side of the court. And so the ball's bouncing at them with a lot of action on it, but you get them to, you put them in a position where they have to move up in the court and play these balls in the rise. And over time, you sort of just create this comfort hitting that kind of ball. And then, you know, you progress it to a live rally where, you know, as a coach, you're behind them and you're on their, you know, you're on their side of the court. And you're saying, move up to that ball, you know, move up to that ball. Like, you know, when you see that ball happening in the rally, when they're hitting with their teammate or whoever it is, you're telling them to move up and telling them to step in and drive the ball. And over time, like, you know, after hearing your voice enough, they either start to do it or they start to recognize it on their own. And, you know, and then it comes from that to like coaching them in the matches and saying, hey, like, we need to try to take more balls on the rise, you know, whatever it is. I want you to try to take more ground in these rallies. And, you know, you find the video and you see if they did it a few times and you show them the good ones and you encourage them to do it more. But, you know, you understand there's going to be a lag between practice and the match for sure. But I think a big part of it is, you know, is coaching them to see it, helping them see what you're seeing so that they start to see what it looks like for themselves. I think that that's a big part of it.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I watch my own child play and there's balls that I'm going, that was a short ball. And he just yeah. kept it neutral, you know, but getting him to understand, cause he'll tell me, no, that wasn't short. And so getting him to realize, you know, the short balls you got when you were in the 10s and 12s and even the 14s look a little different than the short balls in the 16s, right? All right, so what's number three?
Well, I'm going to go one step further. And part of that is imparting to the player that how you guys grade the match, it's not going to be on the misses or the makes. It's going to be on the decisions and how good, you know, Steve or Johnny or whoever, how good that player is at recognizing those situations and hitting the shot that you both agree he needs to hit in order to become a better player. Because the misses and the makes are just going to come with practice. But what we really care about is that decision making to do that, to see that ball and move up to it. You know, because if that's what we're really emphasizing in practice, we have to be really consistent with that messaging to the player to get them, you know, to feel free enough to do it in the match and not to be like, oh, like, you know, you missed four forehands inside the court. Like, what's wrong with you? And it should be, oh man, like, hey, you saw those four short balls. Like, man, that's really good. We just got to continue to work on that forehand.
Yeah, you're praising what you want to repeatedly see. So even if the outcome wasn't 100%. What you wanted, because they made the decision you wanted, then you're yeah. positive. All right. So before you go to number three, you know, that right there made me think about, you talk about grading the match. I'm a former football coach and we would grade the game film. And if the player did what we wanted on, and I would watch the film, I had four defensive linemen. I'd watch the film and I'd watch it four times, right? Each player, I'd watch that player only, give them a plus or minus. And then rewind it, watch the next player. So you're watching every play four times, depending on your position. So how do you grade your tennis film? Is it plus minus? And then you give them a percentage. What does that look like?
Yeah. So I thought, you know, when I look at the film, you know, generally with the players, we have an understanding about, you know, how we're going to sort of grade like success or failure. You know, is the player playing the way that we both agree he or she should play? Are you making decisions in line with who you are as a player? And are you competing your ass off? And then on the side are, you know, the things we talked about, like specific to whoever, like, you know, say Karolina Pliskova, we know she's going to serve to, you know, flat wide and she's down break point. We know that if you serve wide to her forehand on a big point, like she's going to, you know, make errors. Like, are you choosing to do those things that we talked about, like in the big moments? And I'll go back and like, you know, look at the break points, like what happened on the break points. Like, are we getting beat on break point with the thing I told you not to get beat by? You know what I mean? Because nothing, I probably for you as a coach too, nothing pisses me off more than like preparing a player to like see something in a big moment. And that moment comes and goes and you see exactly what you expected to see and the player is like not prepared for it. Like, that drives me nuts, you know?
well, they usually return to their comfort zone, right?
Right. Like, no, I told you Muguruza was going to serve to the tee on 30-40, like on a second serve. Like, she does that. Like, but, you know, there's some deal of empathy that, you know, goes into it. Obviously, it's hard to be out there as a player. And, but,
I love the direction you're headed because you're basically saying we've coached you up. And I like how you said it. You didn't say I told you. You said the things we agreed on, right? Which makes makes the player part of that decision process. So now when I watch the film, for example, and I'm just making something up, but on a break point on the ad side, you're serving, I wanted you to kick out wide to open the court, right? And instead you went to the serve you're most comfortable with, which might be sliced at the body or something. And so I give you a minus even though you won the point. So you're grading what you want to see, not necessarily the outcome, which I love, because that's all they can control is their decision making, and they can't control if they want to lose the point.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes too, like it takes, like, I believe if we help the player, if we help provide structure for the player, either structure with how they play or structure with the game plan, I think structure gives you the freedom to deviate from that structure as you see fit, but because you have that structure, you're inherently brought back to sort of some level of consistency. So if I have a player out there who, you know, is a great competitor and senses something in a moment and they need to deviate, like, I think they totally have the freedom to do that, you know, and I trust them as a competitor to do that if they have a, you know, if I talk to, you know, because these players are very intuitive. And if I ask the player, hey, like, you know, such and such happened on this point, like, what were you thinking? Like, why did you do that? And they, not like in a bad way, but I'm just curious, like, can you explain your thought process? And if they have a good reason, then I'm totally fine with it. You know what I mean? But if it's that just like, sense. I had a player one time tell me that she couldn't keep doing the game plan because the game plan was too hard. And this is a player who was up in a big way on a big player on a big court. And he just told me, I just stopped doing the game plan because it was too hard. And that sent me, like, I had to walk it off for like 20 minutes because I was like so annoyed by that.
That makes sense. If they can justify why they deviated, then you're good. If you ask, why'd you do that? And the answer is, I don't know.
if they saw the adjustment from the opponent happening and then they made an adjustment to the adjustment. Yeah, that's what we want, you know, because I want the player to be a problem solver. So, you know, who am I to question that? Yeah.
All right. So what's number three?
Well, hold on. One quick question before we get there. When you talk about the game plan, and, you know, the one player saying it was too complex or too confusing or too difficult.
Yeah.
Do you write it down for them so that they can refer to it, you know, on changeovers, something that, you know, if they sort of lose their train of thought, they can come back to it?
That's a good question. I think some players like having that stuff. I mean, other, you know, I haven't had a player in a little while that actually wants it written down. But I think that's a really good idea for sure to have. I've seen some players, you know, who like to refer to notes or open a little notebook, but I haven't had somebody who likes necessarily to do that. But I think it's a great idea. And to be honest too, like, as you know, when that happened, I don't know how many years ago that happened. I think now I would respond to that situation a lot differently because I was younger and I was like highly emotionally charged because it was a big court and, you know, it was just a lot happening. And I think now, with a little bit more perspective, I might have a little bit more empathy for that player after that moment. You know what I mean? I think that player is revealing something to me in that moment that I didn't see at the time. And that, you know, now even talking about it, I can see it a little bit more clearly.
And I guess that incident occurred maybe before there was the coaching on court was allowed.
Yeah. It was a grand slam anyway. So yeah.
Yeah. And so what are your thoughts on the on court coaching?
Well, hey, Scott, can we get to know? That's a big topic I want to dive into. Okay. Can we get to that before? I want to hear three, and then I want to dive into that. I love that question.
Okay. But
I think that's going to take us. It's going to take us way off to the side, I think.
Sure.
Number three. The third one, a lot of times, is helping that player work on their defense. Because I think, you know, we talked about number two is like taking away time. Like, I think you have to be really good at creating time. And being able to have like some variance in your game, because again, you look at all these players, everyone's so good when they're hitting on the baseline, hitting up and down the middle, or hitting, you know, in a point when they're ahead in the point and they could look balanced and comfortable. But how do you do when you're playing out of the corners, when you're already behind the rally? Like, are you able to push the player off the baseline? Are you able to slow the tempo of the rally down? Are you able to go from defense to offense and create situations where you can get out of defense and get to offense? And a lot of times it's working on a slice, it's working on, you know, letting the ball settle and getting the ball up on your opponent, getting the ball above their shoulders with depth, pushing them back to the middle of the court. Because, you know, everybody thinks, oh, yeah, I've heard so many players say, you know, what are you doing back here, like referring to their court position? You know, you need to be up on the baseline, and which is all fine and dandy, but, like, if your opponent's pushed you back, you cannot play up on the baseline. You need to figure out how to get yourself back there, and you need to be good at it, because there's always going to be somebody who hits the ball bigger than you. You're not always going to be the alpha, you know, alpha dog when you're playing a match. Like, you're going to, at some point, no matter how big you are, find somebody who's bigger than you and who hits the ball bigger than you. So you need to be able to defend. And I don't care who you are, the best players in the world play unbelievable defense on the men's and women's side. And so you can always improve your defense. And so that's generally, again, without, you know, speaking about a specific player, that's something that I think is very, very important, you know, when I start with a new player. Can they defend?
Well, and diving into that real quick, give me an example of how a player who's on defense gets it back to neutral or flips it to offense. Is it just hitting a big ball? Is it hitting a quality ball that maybe isn't very high above the net? What I mean, I know kind of the Spanish mentality with younger kids is you're on defense, throw a really high ball to kind of reset the point. But when you get in older ages, they'll just hit an overhead or a swing volley and points over. So what are some of those examples that you're on defense and you can hit X type of shot to move it to neutral or offense?
Yeah, generally, so the thing is, if you hit the ball low, it better be deep. It better be on the baseline, because anything low and short, all you're doing is, you know, putting your opponent in a position to take the ball early and to hurt you to the other corner, and you have no time to recover. So you need to figure out, how am I going to slow the speed of this rally down, in my opinion. So, you know, with everybody, it's going to be spending time on the slice, spending time hitting a slice. So, you know, obviously we know the ball moves slower after you slice it. Can you slice deep cross? Can you slice deep middle? Can you take away that angle from another player by keeping them in the middle of the court and pushing them off the baseline? So one's going to be the slice. The other is going to be able to play like a high and heavy ball, and not moon ball, but a ball, you know, with some rotation on it, with some ball speed behind it, and something that's jumping up and at your opponent that, again, lands near the baseline and pushes them off it. Because if you're playing someone good and you hit the ball deep on the, you know, on the baseline in the middle of the court, they're not going to just stand there. If they do, you know, great for you, because they're not going to hit a good ball off it. But if you can pitch the ball deep through the middle with, you know, maybe 8 feet over the net, 8 to 10 feet, 6 to 10 feet, whatever, something like that, with rotation, and again, with power. I'm not talking about pushing. I'm not talking about hitting a moon ball or lifting a ball. I'm talking about being really physical and putting something on the ball. You got to get that player off the baseline. And two, the extra height on the ball is going to give you more time to recover, because you need to be able to get out of the corner and get back to the middle of the court and be able to, you know, to honor both sides. Because again, the faster you hit the ball, if you keep that tempo of the point up from the middle of the court, or excuse me, from the outside of the court, there's no way you can get back to the middle, and you're going to get, you know, you're going to be defending for a second ball. The other reason, even with highly offensive players, the other reason that I value defense and I emphasize it is because it signifies a toughness, a resilience, and like a grit that I want to see from that player that will serve them well regardless of how they're playing. Like, I want to see that character from them. I want to see how tenacious they can be, how hard they fight for that point that they're probably not going to win. You know what I mean? How hard they fought for that point, they're probably not going to win. And what the message that sends over the long term to the opponent, I really like, and I think is really important. And those are the kind of players that I want to be around.
I feel like we're getting a coaching clinic here, Scott. This is awesome.
No, this is fantastic.
I'll talk in time.
Okay, yeah, so
great,
let's
questions talk, too.
Well, let's dive in. Go ahead, Scott, with the coaching, because I like this topic, and I want to take it into, what do you think about it there? But then why do we not do it on the younger ages? So go for it.
Right. So Mark, you've, you know, on the WTA side of it, they had the, I'm not sure if it's an experiment, if it's still going on, but you could go onto the court once per set.
Yep.
Is that still the rule, or is it just from the stands now?
No, it's coaching. It's the same as the men. So you can coach from the sideline. Okay. Pretty much you can chatter as much as you want when the player's on your side of court. On the far side of court, you're not supposed to yell across the court. Some people do, right. But yeah, I think it's fine. I mean, you know, listen, like the way that the referees were enforcing coaching was so inconsistent and it was so gray. You know, I thought that was pretty unfair. Like I have a little funny story. So at the French Open a couple of years ago, Stevie was playing this Brazilian guy, Montero. And near the end of the first set, Montero, his coach got a soft warning, like the, you know, Carlos Ramos was the umpire, and he gave him like, you know, the like the shh, like soft warning sign on a changeover, like tell you, and he told Thiago, like, tell your coach to, you know, stop coaching, but no official warning, you know. And so Stevie hears this, and Stevie's got rabbit ears in the court. He hears everything. So he heard Ramos telling Montero that, and so Stevie gets up out of his chair and he's like, what do you mean soft warning? What is this? Like, you know, was he coaching or was he not coaching? And Carlos is like, well, you know, just warning him. And so Stevie looks at me and he's like, Mark, you get one free coaching. And so I like stand up and I'm like, Carlos, I get one. And Carlos is like, no. And but it's the total, it's the crux of the issue. Like, it's so, you know, it was so poorly enforced. Like, why are we even have a rule about it? So I think now it's fine. I didn't like the on-court coaching where you had to run on the court once a set. It was like so helter-skelter and like panic move, like from the players. And there were some pretty bad looks, like especially with some of the, you know, with the female players having it and the male players didn't. Like, I think whatever coaching rule needs to be consistent on both tours. And if you're going to have on-court coaching, I think the coach literally should be sitting on the court in the chair on the changeover. That's what I think. And it should be there for the coach to be there for the whole match on court. Otherwise, don't have it. I think, you know, like I said, now I think the mechanics of the from the side of the court are fine. Not ideal, but they're fine. And to jump ahead, yeah, it's absolutely criminal that coaches cannot help their kids at junior tournaments because those are the ones who actually need it. I don't understand why we ask kids to do things that we do not ask pro players to do.
Yeah, 100%.
Call their own lines, you know, the whole thing. Call their own lines, play four matches a day. Like, it's just, like, what we ask of kids, like, it's such a poor experience in a lot of ways. Like, I don't blame them, the ones who quit.
Yeah, and Scott and I have that same conversation a lot. We went to a challenger or a future. I can't remember what it was this summer. And I told Scott while I was there, I said, if junior tennis was done like this, it would be super popular. Right. I mean, yeah. the moment players started to have an issue, a ref was right there. And then the ref would just stay the rest of the match and enforce all the rules. And, you know, at a junior tournament, they'll say, well, I got all these courts to cover. And then my question is always, well, is someone else asking you to come? Because if not, stay here, right? But the reality is they just don't want to be on the court. So I'll give you an example. My son plays a tournament a month ago. The two sets split. Well, you know how it goes. No matter what the calls are, somebody's going to complain about the calls, right?
Yep.
So why don't we just be proactive? So the officials there, I say, hey, I'm the dad. Why don't you just stay here for the whole tiebreak? Okay. Well, they get to 8-all and he walks off. So a course at match point, they say, oh, well, that was a bad call. Well, he shouldn't have even been in that position because somebody should have been there watching.
Right.
The dad even asked you to stay, right?
And yeah, so I agree with
you. And then the second piece is the quantity of matches. I mean, how difficult is it for a kid to play two singles matches, two doubles matches, and turn around and do two more singles and two more doubles the very next day? At no other level do they do that. And so people are always like, man, we got a bunch of kids pulling out for injury. Well, I wonder why. Right?
Yeah. Or like, oh, why does that kid have a bad attitude? I don't know. Maybe because all he's eaten today was like a Cliff Bar and like, you know, a sandwich from Jimmy John's 6 hours ago. Like, I mean, come on.
Yeah. So,
coaching,
but going back to the coaching piece, I think there's a lot of missed opportunity in tennis. I think about when I coached middle school and high school football. I mean, the first day of middle school football, the players are putting the butt pad in the front because they're thinking it can do more good there than in back, right? And you have to explain, like, no, that goes in the back. And you think about how much they learn throughout their experience. And in junior tennis, so, in my opinion, so many bad habits are gained because no one's allowed to say anything, do anything, coach anything. And so it becomes kind of this wild, wild west environment. So how do we change it? It's the question. How do we get it where – because I know there are a lot of unintended consequences, right? I mean, you start
letting people coach
and then you get crazy parents out there and the whole thing, right? So what's a scenario where we could have it in the juniors and the unintended consequences or the negative consequences not actually happen?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's a tough one. It's one of the things, like, when David Roditi was running the Carson Center, we used to organize these like Saturday match plays where, you know, we invite another program or two to come to Carson and play with, you know, the kids who were in our program. And we would play matches and, you know, kind of parents would watch like on the side, but we would have coaches kind of, you know, circulating the courts, our coaches. And then the coaches from, you know, whatever academy came, I don't know if Tucker came ever, but whatever academy came, we would have them watching and, you know, we have pizza at the end of the day. So I think different formats, I think it's too hard for this to happen in, you know, the regular USTA formats just because there's so many players and there's so many courts and they're, you know, teaching, you know, the teaching pros are out there teaching lessons and trying to make, you know, make a buck, which I totally get. I think it just, it's going to take people coming up with creative formats. I mean, maybe like in the UTR space, doing that, but yeah, like it's really hard to think of a viable way without having some situation where you have, you know, crazy parent number one fist fighting crazy parent number two because, you know, the one guy said his, you know, his other kid's backhand was terrible and he was highly offended by that. I mean, but yeah, like, you know, to your point, like I watch flag football every Friday night, like a 9-year-old flag football, and they have coaches in the field helping them understand the plays and calling the you know, calling the coverages and stuff. And then when the kids mess up, you know, they got the clipboard, they're able to, you know, show them how to do it. And, you know, the rate of improvement is like accelerated because of that. So we got to do better in tennis for sure.
You think about golf. I mean, when I would play a big tournament as a kid, my dad would caddy and he's coaching me all the way through the thing.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's
it's
just that it's a sport where, honestly, I wasn't a tennis person. I can't believe people choose it after having gone through it. There's so many good lessons in it, and I love it. But, man, there's so many small things that could be done to make it better. But go ahead, Scott.
Well, just on that notion, you know, we talk about, you know, not being able to talk to the kids during the match. But then after the match, then everyone's, oh, you got to cool down. And you sort of lose the moment, I think,
the learning opportunities. Yep.
Yeah. Cause it's like, you know, right after the match, you know, you can say, I remember that, but then they don't want to hear it. And then 2 hours later, when you talk about it, they forgot all about it. And so, you know, and so you really, it's like, see that learning curve, like see when you talk about, you know, the defensive back coach coaching the kids up in football right after the play. Oh yeah. Okay. I'll do it the next time. You lose that. And then you've got to either watch it on video. You got to somehow bring back that moment, but it is tough. And then you feel like you do lose a lot of the learning opportunities by not having the right time to address that. But, and you know, maybe that's a good question for you right now is, you know, how would you deal with, say, Stevie or Shelby right after a loss? Is it, you know, hands off for a period of time, or do they want to talk? What was that like?
And I want to add to that question because that's a great one. And so, and then how would you alter that for a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's so hard. I mean, it's, you know, the first thing is like so it's different, obviously, with the male players and the female players.
Hold on. What are those differences? Yeah. Why is it different?
Well, so I would say it's strictly because of the locker room situation. Like, so I can go in the locker room with Steve and, like, you know, put my arm around him and be like, hey, dude, like, you know, freaking tough. I mean, even still, like, it's awkward for me. Like, because I'm like, God, this guy just, you know, this player just, you know, bowed their ass off and they lost. And I see, like, the eyes are red and, like, all this, you know what I mean? I'm like, oh, my God. So in that moment, like, yeah, I go in there and, you know, I put my arm around him. Or I sit across from him and, you know, I try to, like, say something, even though it's so awkward, just because you don't, you know, this person just laid on the line and came up short. That's the biggest reason is, you know, because people talk about the male and female, blah, blah, blah. Like, for me, it's just a locker room access. So with the female players, if I can see them right after, generally, you know, like, people are pissed off. It's highly emotionally charged. If you're pissed off or sad or both. So maybe it's a quick hug and they go in the locker room and cool off. And then I see them 30 or 40 minutes later, you know, depending on, you know, what tournament it is, if they have media, that whole thing. And then, you know, sometimes we try to, you know, I generally don't go over stuff like very close to the match, like nothing specific to the match, like right away, unless they bring it up. Some players will just start talking about the match right away, after their shower, or even, you know, if it's a guy during the locker room. But I kind of let the player take the lead with how the post-match kind of goes. Generally, it's going to take some empathy from me and some sort of, you know, hey, what do you need right now? Like, you know, what can I get for you? Like, you know, do you need to run to the, you know, whatever, dining and bring you back, you know, such and such. But these are professionals. Like, they have all their drinks. They have all their, you know, recovery stuff. They got their protein shake. Like, they're all good. But it's just, you know, hey, can I help you out in this moment? Like, oh, like, do you need to talk to the agent and tell them this, this, and this, or whatever it is? So generally, it's just some empathy and some support after the match and be like, hey, man, you freaking battled out there. Like, good work. Even though, you know, for the player, a lot of times those are like hollow words, but I think they just don't want to feel alienated after the match. I mean, I had one coach tell me a long time ago the player needs some cooling off period. And so, you know, you give a player a cooling off period and the player's like, hey, where were you? I just, you know, I needed you after the match, you know? So you just have to understand who you're dealing with. For kids, you know, it's probably going to be a hug or a high five or something after the match. And, you know, you pull them in tight and, I think that messages specific to like tactics and tennis, like, don't really get through until the player can think about the match without emotion. And that varies. That can be later that day. It can be the next day. I had one player who couldn't talk about a match for about a week without emotion. And she, you know, like, tried to show her video and she couldn't watch it because it was too, you know, it hurt her too much. So it's just knowing who you're coaching and that sort of thing. But yeah, generally after a match, especially if a match that goes bad, it's going to be some sort of empathy. A match that goes well, they'll go straight to the bike and do their cool down and want to talk about, hey, did you see the forehand I hit? Blah, blah, blah. You know, just it's all different. But if there's some real teaching that takes place, I think you need to find your moment where they're able to actually take in the information.
That makes sense. So what does the post-match routine look like? What are they drinking? What are they, you see some of them doing like a cool down on the bike. What would you recommend as a, for a 15-year-old, 16-year-old as a post-match end-of-day routine?
Yeah. So for the pros, generally, like, I don't have to teach anyone a routine. Like, they know, like, especially someone who's been out there for a little while, they know what works for their body. And so I trust them, you know, especially if, like, I see it and I see that there's a routine to it, like, then I trust them to do what they know works for themselves. For 15, you're in a teaching phase. And so, you know, I really like to put the screws to them and have them do a very clear cool down. So that might be, you know, it might be a jog, it might be a bike, if there's a bike there. You know, if it's a junior tournament, it might be, you know, jogging for 5 minutes, or even like a, you know, a brisk walk around a field or something like that. So it's going to be a walk, stretch, some sort of recovery drink, can be from as basic as chocolate milk to something, you know, more specific that player likes to drink, where they're putting a little protein carb combo in their body. So something like that, where, like, you know, they're kind of loosening up the body. They put that, you know, the good stuff back in the body with a recovery drink, and then like a nice sort of a nice stretch, like a nice kind of old school stretch, like a static stretch. And then, yeah, if they need to go to the trainer, if there's a trainer there, if they have like problem areas in their body that they need to ice, like that's part of the cool down as well. And then once all that's done, you know, changing, you know, if you need to shower, but at least putting on some dry clothes. And then getting out of there to go get something to eat. But I like to see a routine that's kind of diligent and that touches the different areas we need to do, you know?
Yeah, that's you don't see many kids doing those things. And the ones that do it tend to be, you know, the ones that are performing better. So it sort of goes into the whole, you know, their whole rituals are a lot more disciplined, and that shows up. So, yeah, I think that needs to be addressed and needs to be, you know, if you're not doing it, you need to start working on that for sure.
Yeah, it's attention to detail, you know, and people that are really good have a high level of attention to detail.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Scott.
No, go ahead, Robert.
Well, I'm just wondering, well, you go and then I'll ask.
Well, I wanted to change topics a little bit. So if you want to hit on that, keep going.
Well, I just think about pros that, and you mentioned getting some of their problem areas worked on. How much pain would you say the average pro's playing with on a tournament to tournament, match to match? Because I doubt there's time where their body is 100% at all times. So how much pain are they playing with? And at what point does it become where they're like, all right, I have to withdraw?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think generally, I think the level of discomfort kind of varies from person to person. I mean, if you're talking about someone who's been on tour for, you know, for 8 to 10 years, I think they're having probably a higher level of discomfort than someone who, you know, is 20 or 21, just because, you know, of the miles on the body in that way. But yeah, I think it's rare that you feel great, especially as you get into the year. I think when it comes to the place where you feel like you can't perform, I think that's when a player should, and I'm using air quotes, like should, you know, consider like withdrawing. I mean, I think everybody's threshold for that is different. I mean, I think, you know, you'll have some players who will be like, I've never retired from a match in my life, you know, or withdrawn from a tournament in my life. And you'll have other players who seem to do it more often than others and seem to have a much lower threshold for pain or for the toughness kind of required out there. But I, you know, I like to help my players find like the highest level medical support that I know of. And that's been one of the things as a coach, like I maybe misjudged, was like the level of depth that my medical contact book sort of needed to have to work at this level. And now, like, you'd be shocked at how many doctors and trainers and, you know, sports medicine people I have in my phone at any one time. But, you know, if I try to find the best people around, you know, to surround my players with. And when these people sort of, so, you know, when they are able to, you know, work with the player, diagnose things with the player, and they say that the player can play, you know, I lean that way. If they say that the player, you know, they think the player's going to have a hard time playing, then it's a discussion that we need to have about not playing. And I think the best players in the world when they feel they can prepare adequately for a tournament, they play regardless of how they feel. I think when their preparation starts to become impeded and they don't feel prepared to play, I think that's the sort of gauge they use on whether or not they go to a tournament.
Yeah, in other words, can they get good enough to be at their best level? And if they can't practice to get it to be peaking, then they just don't want to be a part. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, it just you start to go down this road. I mean, you know, I've had players that have had injuries and stuff like that, and they, you know, they continue to play, and we try to patch together practices. Like, it's just brutal. It's brutal to put a player through that. It's brutal to put yourself through that as a coach. So, you know, the goal that I try to have always is, like, how can we put together a schedule that sort of optimizes our ability to go to tournaments prepared, you know? And if we don't go to tournaments prepared, like, we need to reevaluate some things and figure out how we can try to do that as much as we can. I mean, obviously, sometimes, you need to rest 4 or 5 days and then you practice maybe a day or two, then go to a tournament. Like, that's part of life. But if there are serious physical issues that are preventing the player from playing, you know, or from putting their best foot forward, then I think, yeah, that's when you kind of consider not playing.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, Scott.
Yes. Well, it's actually a good question because it sort of led into where I wanted to go on this next topic real quick. But here are a lot of people complaining about wrist and shoulder injuries because there's different balls that are used week to week, tournament to tournament.
Yeah, hot topic.
Yeah, and, you know, it's sort of the same thing with juniors because, I mean, if you go to, like, a junior probably won't play with a fresh ball all week in practice. Then they go to a tournament, they're playing with, you know, fresh balls. They're playing, you know, like you say, 4 or 5 matches a day when they haven't been doing that. And so, you know, but it is a hot topic on the Pro Tour. And what do you think about that? You know, is it as simple as just having one ball that is used year round, but then, you know, different climates require different balls and, you know, altitudes and et cetera. So, you know, what's the solution?
Yeah. I mean, ideally, I think you have one ball per surface. And generally, like, you know, if you think about, like, the lead up to Australia, like the tournaments in Australia are generally pretty good about, they play with the same ball. They play with, like, the Dunlop AO ball. And, you know, the lead up to the U.S. Open, like, it's all over the place. Because, like, in the past, you've had, like, a D.C. use a pen ball, and then you switch the next week, like, in Cabo, I think, a Wilson ball. And then, you know, you switch back in Cincy to a pen ball, and Montreal uses a Wilson ball. Like, just switching every week is pretty bad for the players just because, you know, regardless of what the manufacturers say, the balls are different. And the balls weigh different. Amounts, and, you know, we're talking like grams, but still it's significant. If you're a player who's hitting hundreds of shots, like with, you know, with a tennis racket and a tennis racket that's strung with, you know, polyester strings, like, it adds up. And these balls have become so heavy. Like, it's just these courts, the courts on tour, I don't think are quite as slow as people think. They've started to speed up. However, the tennis balls, like, more and more tournaments are using heavy, heavy tennis balls. And I think there's just not a true appreciation for what that does, you know, to the players. Like, I have the, but we were hitting with these balls from Indian Wells the other day that are so freaking heavy. And, like, I save cans in tournaments and they'll use them with the kids I give lessons to. And, yeah, we were hitting with the Indian Wells balls and they're so heavy compared to, you know, the Wilson balls from the U.S. Open that we used a couple days later, like when I popped that backhand. It's just... Yeah, it's hard for the players, and I totally get it. I mean, it's their livelihood. And, you know, a couple of years, right before the pandemic, in 2019, actually, 2018, 2019, the WTA was very, very close to having one ball. They had been testing for a year or two, and they had sent cases to different players to sort of test them and get their opinions. They were very, very close to doing one ball. And then the pandemic happened, and there were ball shortages worldwide. And then I think the tournaments were kind of such financial distress on both the men's and the women's sides that, you know, the extra income from ball contracts, like, helps. So everybody kind of is back to sort of square one with their getting their own ball contracts and using whatever ball would pay them the most.
Well, so I think of it different. Could WTA and ATP not just say, here's the maximum the ball can weigh and use whatever brand you want, but it can't weigh more than this amount?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know the physics of it enough or the chemistry of it enough. Like, if it's just a matter of, like, you know, a weight, I don't know if the consistency of someone's felt is different because, you know, if you start feeling tennis balls, like, if you feel a ball, like, if, you know, if you put a ball in my hand, I can, like, hold it and I can tell you this is a Wilson ball because of how tight the weave is. If someone, you know, hands me a pen ball, I can feel it and it feels differently. It's like someone gives me a Dunlop ball and I can squeeze it. Like I know that squishy ball is a Dunlop ball, you know? So I think there's more to it than the weight. I think it's the makeup of the ball. I think it's how much the ball compresses, you know, at contact. I think there's a whole lot. So maybe if someone's like, be like, hey, like these are all like the specifications and the parameters that need to be met. I mean, to be honest, like, like a lot of these balls come from the same place. Like, I think they should just run one ball and just put different logos on it.
but then what's the best ball?
It depends who you are. Like, I mean, Americans, we love the Wilson ball. Nearly all the Americans love the Wilson US Open ball because that's the ball, you know, we've played with since we were juniors. You know, all the nationals, all like college, like everyone uses the Wilson US Open ball. Like, but you talk to the Europeans, they think, oh, the ball's too lively, blah, blah, blah. We like the Dunlop ball because we grew up playing with that on clay, whatever it is. It just depends who you are, where you're from, what's your game like. That's why Swiatek wanted to use the Wilson Extra Duty. That's why she was complaining all last year because the other ball was so fast for her. She wanted to use the Extra Duty because it would slow the points down. It would get nice and fluffy for her. She could play high and heavy. She could defend against the big hitters. You know, I saw Rybakina on the practice court, and I was like, do you like this new ball? She's like, no, I like the old one because the old one was like faster and tighter, and she could hit the crap out of it, and the points were shorter. So everybody, you know, everyone wants to use what's in their best interest. That's the thing.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting.
But my son's played tournament.
Why the Patriots inflated, you know, why the Patriots deflated those footballs, you know, so Tom Brady could hold on to them a little more.
That's a fact. That's exactly why.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Mark, I know we're getting a little bit over the hour mark and we want to keep this around this time, but we wanted to ask you a few fast feed questions. So if you don't mind, we'll jump into that.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's go. Robert, are you in the document?
Yeah, so okay. First question, something you have learned from David Nankin and David Roditi.
Oh, man. David Nankin is when you break a string with a poly racket, you flip the racket over from the way you were holding it, you flip it the other way, and you still have tension for like at least two shots with the part of the string bed that hasn't been broken. That's number one.
Okay, that's interesting.
With David, because juniors will go to the forehand slice way too often, and Nank's big thing is they do not go to the forehand slice too often. You flip the racket, and you flip it. So you still have tension on the other half of the racket of the string bed that you didn't break. Because usually, you know, you never break strings right in the center because you're hitting topspin. Right. So usually you're slightly off center with the main that you broke. So if you flip it, so the other part of the other half of the string bed's on top now, that's where you're going to make contact. And so you have enough tension with the poly for like at least another two shots.
Huh. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
And then
it's like unbelievable with the strings. And with Roditi, the big thing with David is, I mean, so I'll say it's specific to me. David really emphasized to me how important having energy as a coach is. And that's kind of like, I can be like very mellow. And David obviously is the king of energy. And so he really encouraged me and made me aware of like what kind of energy I was putting out as a coach on court. And so that's something, I mean, that I've learned from him and taken to heart, and I'm forever grateful.
All right. Your racket string intention.
I use a version of the head radical. My racket's 27.5 inches. Might be 27.25 actually. I think it's 27.25. It's like it was Zverev specs. I got to use one of his rackets one time from one of my friends from head, and I just asked for the same one. So anyway, it's a radical tricked out. I don't know how much it weighs. It's like 330 something grams. I'm using right now one of the Solinco round strings. I think it's a prototype. And it's strung at 42 pounds.
42, that's interesting because a lot of people early were going lower and now I'm seeing a return to higher stringing tension. So that's interesting, you're at 42.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm old, I need a little power.
Easy on the arm.
Exactly.
All right, so favorite book, movie, and he's got podcast, but I don't want to know your favorite podcast because it's probably one that you've been on or that you do. So
no.
Favorite book?
I listen to Stuck in my favorite book.
Or book movie.
Or movie.
And it can be, we want one tennis and one non-tennis.
Okay. My favorite book is, I would say, I'm actually rereading it right now. It's called The Art of Learning by Josh Waitzkin. He was the kid that the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer was about. He was a chess prodigy, and he wrote a book called The Art of Learning. And I think it's really it provides a lot of insight into I think the habits of high level performers. So I like that book, and then movie. Gosh, most recently, man, I love Top Gun Maverick. I've probably seen it 5 times. I saw it once after the French. I think I saw it twice in London at Wimbledon. I watched it at least once on the plane, and I think once here at home too. So yeah, I love Top Gun Maverick.
All right. Hey, advice to a young coach. So, your younger self or a young coach right out of college that's going into the profession.
So, I would highly, highly suggest trying to seek out mentors. I've been very lucky because, you know, like I said, I had this sort of group at the USTA. But when I left the USTA, I obviously still knew that I had a ton to learn. So, I really worked to create that for myself, whether it's like calling Nankin and saying, David, can I come to practice today and like hang out? Like calling Peter Smith, Peter, can I drive to USC and have lunch with you today? CB, Craig Boyton, like, hey, CB, can I come and hang out with you guys at practice? Really, like, to be honest, I worked my ass off to like create that situation for myself where I was around people that knew more than me and where I was constantly like asking them, you know, just learning from them or asking them questions or just seeing how they operate. I would suggest any young coach that wants to be good at what they do, try to find people more experienced than you. There are very few people in our business who do not like to share, who do not like to talk tennis, who do not like, especially to, you know, to give back to the young coaches. So, you know, be brave, take a chance, call somebody you don't know or email somebody or reach out to somebody on social. And more than likely, the people, you know, would love to sit down and talk with you and help you out.
That's good stuff. I agree. As a former coach, I learn more from other coaches I work with than anybody else. So that's great advice.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. I'm going to skip number 5, Scott. You can ask that one. I want to ask this next one. So what's something that you once thought to either be true or false that now you've changed your opinion on it? So you thought it was true. Now you realize it's false or the other way around.
I thought that character didn't matter and that it only mattered if a player was talented or not. When I was a young coach, I thought that, and I 1000% know that that's not true to the,
That's interesting. I'd love to hear. I know we can't do it now, but I'd love to hear the story behind how you figured that out. Because I imagine
We sat with Jim Lehrer. We sat with Jim Lehrer, and he said that the ultimate competitors are people of the highest level character. And I thought he was completely full of shit. And excuse my language. And about, you know, at least I think within a year or within 2 years from that moment, I was like, God, I was so freaking wrong. And now today, to me, that's all that matters. It's, you know, someone's character, how tough they are.
Well, and if they're on ATP, they're all good. So the thing that can separate them is character. But all right.
Yeah, but even any level, kid, high school, college, those are the kind of people I want to be around.
That makes total sense. All right, Scott.
All right. Favorite restaurant on the road. And, you know, this could be in the U.S. or it could be in Europe or Australia, wherever you want.
Una Pizzeria Napolitana in the Lower East Side of New York. Chef Anthony Mangieri, who I'm lucky to call, I think maybe a friend of mine now, he's got a pizza place called Una, makes these unbelievable pizzas. They go in the oven. His oven's probably like 900 degrees. They go in there for like 3 minutes and come out. His ingredients are just the freshest and most incredible. He makes the dough by hand each morning, and it's an absolute treat to go there. And I go there whenever I'm in New York.
All right. That's good. That's good stuff. And proud you didn't say Chipotle.
No, come on, man.
That's the most common answer. What's something you believe to be true that everybody else thinks you're crazy that you believe that?
I believe that the tennis season should end at the U.S. Open. I believe there's such a crescendo of media attention at U.S. Open finals weekend. And then the very next week, like, players are playing in the middle of night in freaking Asia. I don't get it. Like, as a sport, I don't understand how we keep shooting ourselves in the foot. There's a lot of reasons. Don't even get me started. Like, if you want to take your family to the U.S. Open, like, next year, and you want to watch Ben Shelton, how do you buy tickets?
Oh, yeah, totally agree. I mean, it's the whole thing is not built around the spectator or TV.
Yeah.
It's just a giant event. It's almost like a carnival instead of I want to watch this player. I agree.
Yeah. Well, that's, but anyway, that's anyway, I think the season should end at the U.S. Open. I think the year-end championships should be maybe after that, right after that or whatever. And then the fall can be team tennis, but I don't think there should be tournaments after the US Open.
I think a lot of fans, they sort of lose interest after the U.S. Open. You're right. It's a long season. You've been invested in it from, you know, really from, you know, Australia through Europe and then to the U.S., North America swing. And it's a lot. And now there's other things that are going on. And maybe that's a U.S.-centric way of thinking things because, you know, football's big over here now. And so everyone's sort of priorities have changed and we're sort of done with tennis. So, yeah. Makes sense. Let's see. What as a coach, what is your favorite tournament, a major and non-major?
I love Roland Garros. I've been fortunate to have players who win a lot of matches there, and I love Paris. I love having days off in Paris where I can walk around, and you know, there's a couple places I like to go. So Paris for the majors. Non-major. I love Charleston. When I was coaching female players, I love going to Charleston. You know, playing golf in Daniel Island, the people that run the tournament are the best, absolutely best. Bob Moran and Eleanor Peters. For the men's tournaments, I like Cabo. I love Cabo and Acapulco. I love being in Mexico. I mean, that's where my family's from. So I love those events. I can jump in the ocean. I can surf there. And it feels like home.
That's awesome. And this is the last question. And I want to say, just speaking for me and Scott, this has been great. It's been a blast to have you on.
Thank you, guys.
What do you think tennis can do to grow in popularity? And I think this is a really good question. It's a long conversation, so you can just give something quick. But, I mean, again, I'm at the ITA All-American, two best college players in the country playing, and there were probably 50 people there, right? So how can we grow it? How can we make it more popular?
You know, I think tennis has so many issues. I think from, you know, I'm a big believer that I think the college format should be changed. I think that, you know, if you have a six-court stadium, I think doubles and singles should be simultaneous. I think the matches are too long. I think doubles can be, you know, one set. By the time you finish a set of doubles, you're early in the second set of singles. I think, again, like, I don't like when you have, like, all this excitement and all this dead time. I like in doubles, like, the doubles point, the end of the doubles point is so exciting. And then, like, you have this lull for 10 minutes. You know, then the singles get started and it's boring for like an hour. I think you need to kind of build in that excitement. So I think one, like figuring out how can we deliver a more fan-friendly product, either in, you know, college by changing the format, in the pros by letting people know when the, you know, the top players are going to be playing more so it can be more family accessible, people can plan. That's kind of like, it's such a long conversation, like you said, but I think doing things to be more fan-friendly and to engender more, you know, more support, specifically like with an in-person audience, and then I think that'll translate to media attention if done right.
Great. Mark, again, thanks so much for being on. We really appreciate your time and everything. So where will we be the rest of the year, and where can people reach out to you or find you on the socials?
Yeah, I'm going to be home for a part of it. I'm going to be going to Florida for part of it. So I'll be around. People can hit me up either on, you know, Instagram or Twitter, at Mark Lucero, just spelled how I spell it, MARCLUCERO. That's kind of where I hang out, and people, you know, want to talk tennis and engage. I'm happy to engage. And otherwise, like, man, thank you guys for having me on. Really enjoyed the conversation. I love diving into the nuts and bolts of, you know, of coaching, and especially talking with people who have coaching backgrounds and from other sports too. I love like learning and, you know, hearing how other people do it. So thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks so much.
All right, guys. Thanks.
All right. Thanks again.